Every year on New Year's Day, a lot of us make resolutions to lose weight, to save money, to be more organized. Sadly, most of those resolutions fail. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll talk about making resolutions you can keep, resolutions that will actually enhance your life. I'll talk with Mitch Horowitz, author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. And later in the hour, clinical psychologist Kevin Krumvita will be here. We'll talk about setting and achieving realistic goals. We also want to hear about your goals for 2014. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Every year on January 1st, many of us make resolutions to change things about ourselves and to change things about our lives. Every year, many people write articles about how to put our resolutions into practice. This year, one of those columns caught my attention. It was written by Mitch Horowitz and published in Time, and it's called Five Simple Steps to a Better 2014. Resolutions Will Fail. Here's Something Easier and Better. Mitch Horowitz is more than a columnist. He's someone who's given ideas about how we can change our own destiny a whole lot of thought. His book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life, comes out tomorrow, and he is with me now. Hello, Mitch.
Hello, glad to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And now that I've read your book, I see your article about resolutions as kind of a succinct summary of some of your biggest takeaways from all of this extensive research you did into positive thinking. So we're going to save some of those big ideas for later on. But your interest in positive thinking came from a very natural place, a place that it comes from for a lot of us. You were a kid who wanted your life to be different. Tell me the first ideas you encountered.
Sure. When I was just entering adolescence, we came very close to losing our home because of financial disaster. It's the kind of thing that befalls a lot of families. And I was searching for a piece of driftwood to hang on to. I felt I needed a set of guidelines that would help get me through that period, get me through life. And I began just voraciously reading Emerson and some of the ethical books of the Talmud and self-improvement literature. My reading tastes were very wise. And I again and again came upon this idea that our thoughts do more than help us navigate experience, but they could actually have some effect over experience. And it made a very deep impression on me around age 12, 13, and we were able to emerge from our financial problems. I don't attribute that to positive thinking, but at the same time, I could never quite discount the possibility that those ideas were one source of help.
As you grew older, you actually worked for someone who was a purveyor of positive thought and ideas that could change your life?
Oh, well, actually, it was my mother-in-law, Teresa Orr, who recently retired as a dean at Harvard Medical School. And she has been a lifelong exponent of motivational thought and positive thinking. And, you know, the truth is, in many parts of our culture, positive thinking is considered superficial or shallow or just a philosophy of, you know, page-a-day calendars or refrigerator magnet expressions. But she was an example to me over the course of my adult life that somebody could live from a place of great intellectual strength and also rely upon positive and motivational thinking as a day-to-day method to help get through life and improve life.
What made you want to dig further into the origin of these ideas?
I came to feel that these ideas were very powerful, but were also very widely disrespected in most reaches of academia and journalism. There's been a lot of criticism of positive thinking, and some of it very good and very valid, but it doesn't tell the full story. The methods of positive thinking can seem so simple, you know, just the idea of trying to shift your mindset to a more affirmative point of view or to see another person in a more positive light. These things seem so simple that we want to dismiss them, but they were the result of many, many generations of effort of people in this country and other parts of the world to find simple methods that could bring spiritual and psychological ideas into play in an effective way in daily life. So while these things are very simple, there's a vast history behind them. And as far as I'm concerned, there's a heroic cohort of men and women behind them, stretching back to the 19th century and earlier, who were struggling to bring spiritual experiments and methods into practical use in daily life.
Now, of course, we don't have time to tell the whole history because you spent 350 pages telling the whole history. But let's go back to the origins in the United States. Where did this begin?
It really began with mental healing experiments in New England in the mid-19th century. American medicine was in a terrible state throughout much of the 19th century. In fact, the medical sciences lagged behind all other sciences and progress in America. We're a nation of immigrants, and the fact is there were very few doctors who were leaving Europe and making the journey across the Atlantic. They were well treated in Europe, and we had very few legitimate medical colleges or teaching institutions in this country. It wasn't really until the late 19th century that turned around. People were desperate for alternatives, and one of the alternatives they hit upon was prayer therapy, mental healing, things that today we might associate with what came to be called the placebo effect. And out of that grew the idea that the mind could have causative effects. That's what gave rise to the positive thinking philosophy in America.
Well, and some of it was really quite magical thinking.
Some of it was, yes. Americans are enthusiasts. That is a constant rule. And if you give a group of American experimenters an idea, let's say mental healing, they will eventually take that idea further than whoever started it had ever imagined it could be taken. So the idea that your mind could have an effect on the body eventually morphed by the late 19th century into the idea that your mind could also have an effect on finances, on your career, on all kinds of things. And so there's this constant tug and pull in our society between just this excessive zealotry and enthusiasm and wish to apply an idea everywhere, but also at the same time, there have been many legitimate studies in the sciences, ranging from psychology to medicine, even to the physical sciences, which raise continual questions about the capacities of our minds.
Some of the interesting early examples, you describe a relationship between the idea of mental healing and positive thinking and some experimental religions. And it was really the basis for some of these religious groups that were on the fringe at first, like Christian Science, for example.
Yes. Christian Science was really one of the most significant new religions to emerge in America. It was founded by a New Englander named Mary Baker Eddy in the 1870s. She was an absolutely brilliant, remarkable person, a lot like other American religious experimenters who had an unmet need in her life. In her case, she was suffering from a variety of maladies. The health care that was available to her was completely insufficient. This was true for many Americans. And she turned to the Bible, and she came to feel that we had misunderstood what life was actually composed of, that matter and sickness and other maladies like prejudice and violence are not real. The only truth is that which emanates from God. And if the individual can strip away the illusions of the world and come in touch with the one true intelligence of God, they can experience physical relief and healing and relief in other areas of life as well. In a sense, it's an idea that has a lot in common with certain Eastern religious faiths, but she hit upon it herself in the parlors and drawing rooms of New England. She was a great experimenter.
It was fascinating to me to learn that in some ways this positive thinking approach and the place that it had in some of these more experimental religions eventually influenced our very established religions to also change really the way they did business, to become more positive.
Absolutely. You know, really, by the time of the Great Depression in this country, Americans started to demand that mainstream churches provide practical answers, practical solutions. People wanted financial advice. They wanted marital advice. They wanted help with addictions. The Alcoholics Anonymous movement grew out of some very traditional churches. People who were not part of any metaphysical religion or new religious movement, but who attended very mainstream churches and saw themselves as mainstream everyday people, were aware of some of the mental healing and positive thinking experiments, and they wanted their churches to start sounding more like that. Church attendance really began to drop off in this country in the 1920s and 30s, and it seems to have rebounded when the mainline churches began to respond to that call. So in a sense, positive thinking really has remade all of American religion as a more giving it a more practical tone. The salvational aspect of American religion was never jettisoned, but American religion had to become both salvational and healing. That was the demand of much of the public.
Well, and you already mentioned how the Americans took these ideas farther than anybody had ever imagined they could be taken. But it is interesting. It seems like the idea of mental healing, although that still is present even in modern medicine, as well as many different ideas in modern life, but it seemed to decouple from medicine as medicine got better. The idea of positive thinking, healing people, medicine actually could heal people at a certain point.
By the turn of the century, American medicine experienced a dramatic step forward, and people were not as experiencing the kind of acute desperation that they felt through much of the 19th century. At the same time, the economy was growing. People were moving off farms, moving into industrial jobs, moving into office-based jobs in cities. In fact, for the first time, a majority of Americans began to shift out of the agricultural economy into the business economy, and they needed help. They not only wanted to accumulate things, but they wanted to know how to behave in office settings. What constituted professional behavior? How should you act toward customers? How should you act towards your boss? And there was a variety of metaphysical literature that had grew out of the earlier mental healing movement that responded to that, and that not only counseled good conduct in the workplace, but counseled that the same metaphysical agencies that could heal the body could also expand the purse. And Americans just embraced this idea and never looked back.
Well, and some of the titles that you write about, Think and Grow Rich by Napoleon Hill, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. I mean, some of these titles are still turned to by people today.
Yes.
And I was really surprised by how far back they date.
Yes, yes. They both go back to the 1930s, and they are available today in vast editions. Napoleon Hill, in particular, sells probably millions of copies a year today around the world. People read these books, and they, if they approach them at the right time in their lives, they describe them sometimes as life-changing experiences. Now, a lot of critics don't like these books. You know, the titles seem shallow. They even seem cynical in a certain way. And my message to critics is don't neglect the opportunity to at least read some of this literature, because whatever one ultimately comes to think of a Dale Carnegie or of a Napoleon Hill, whether one comes to feel their ideas are legitimate or not, these figures were brilliant observers of human nature, and there's a psychological shrewdness in these books that critics might not detect unless they read them.
I'm talking with Mitch Horowitz. He is the author of a book called One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. The book will be released tomorrow. We're also talking this hour about reshaping ourselves, something a lot of us think about on January 1st every year. And coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk about Ronald Reagan and how he very strongly influenced how we think about ourselves in the United States of America. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and this hour I'm talking with Mitch Horowitz. He is the author of One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. It comes out tomorrow, and he grabbed my attention recently with a column that he published in Time called Five Simple Steps to a Better 2014. Resolutions will fail. Here's something easier and better. We'll get to some of those ideas in a moment, but right now we're talking about the evolution of positive thinking and how it first came about as an idea that we could heal ourselves when modern medicine wasn't modern back in the 19th century. We could heal ourselves through positive thought was where these ideas first emerged. And now, really, positive thinking, Mitch, has become the American credo and the person who you give the most credit for turning that into the American credo, that anything is possible, is the man who said that, Ronald Reagan.
Yes, yes, indeed. If you take a look at Reagan's speeches and statements from the 1950s up through his presidency in the 1980s, you find the telltale phraseology and expressions of the positive thinking movement. A lot of historians and journalists have scratch their heads over who this man really was. You know, people found Reagan this inscrutable figure. They couldn't figure out what were his operating instructions, you know, what was his programming, who was this cheerful conservative activist, you know, who emerged out of Hollywood in the 1950s and went on to become one of the most influential presidents of the 20th century. Reagan can't be understood without seeing him indirectly as a part of the positive thinking movement. It was a basic part of his political speech, his political template, his outlook. And in fact, when Reagan began rising to national prominence and saying things like, this is a nation where nothing is impossible, Americans probably wouldn't have been able to even make sense of that message if we weren't a nation raised on generations of motivational psychology. You know, Dwight Eisenhower didn't talk that way. Richard Nixon didn't talk that way. And lo and behold, we have our current president, Barack Obama, clipping phrases out of Ronald Reagan. Obama said in a recent State of the Union address, America is a nation where anything is possible. That wasn't language that you would have heard much in the pre-Reagan days.
Well, I have to take us back to before Ronald Reagan was president to a little bit of time he spent in Iowa, which influenced his ideas as a positive thinker at the Palmer School, because he worked for WOC Radio.
Yes.
That stood for World of Chiropractic. And
yes.
Colonel B.J. Palmer was the man behind that, who and his father had founded the school in Davenport, right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
And give me an idea of some of the credo of the Palmer School.
Well, in the early 1930s, Reagan was given his first break into radio by the Palmer family. They maintained a radio station at their chiropractic school, and they hired Reagan as an announcer. And BJ was just a force of nature. You know, BJ was everywhere at once. He was a showman. He was a genius. He could be frustratingly flashy to some people, and he was a committed positive thinker. And BJ plastered the school with all these positive thinking slogans: I can, I know, I can achieve. And Reagan would encounter these things as he would walk the halls of the school. BJ's theory was that we had an inner God within us, which BJ called innate, and that if you called upon innate, you could find the answers to every problem and heal every illness and so forth. This was the kind of thought Reagan was surrounded by as a young man before he ventured to Hollywood. And Reagan writes about it every now and then in his memoirs. He didn't seem at all taken aback by it. It wasn't strange to him. It wasn't unusual. Reagan's mother, Nell, was a committed self-improver and positive thinker. He had been around that kind of phraseology and those kinds of motivational slogans ever since he had been a kid. So when he encountered the Palmer family, he wasn't taken aback. You know, in some ways, this was good old American metaphysics. And by the time Reagan got to Hollywood, where he spent three decades and became involved with some very New Age ideas, he already had grown up, you know, in a sense, on positive thinking metaphysics.
And you also write about, you know, some of the people who really have made a difference with these ideas. And listening to you talk, I can clearly tell that there are a lot of pieces of this philosophy that make a lot of sense to you. But you also write about charlatans as well. And this is a world that attracted a lot of charlatans.
Yes. Whenever there's an ideology for sale in America, there are always people who are prepared to step up and create false expressions of it. You certainly had a lot of people in the 1920s, 1930s, and probably extending up through today, issuing knockoffs of Think and Grow Rich or books of that ilk that just really wanted to sell people on the most sensationalistic ideas of this philosophy. I think the positive thinking movement needs to undergo a kind of reformation in the 21st century and needs to move away from ideas like the law of attraction, which was popularized most recently by the book and movie The Secret. The idea that we live under one overarching mental super law that determines everything, good or bad, that happens in our lives is just not defensible. That doesn't reflect the experience of vast numbers of sensitive people over the course of many, many generations who experience illness and suffering, even in atmospheres of love and hopefulness.
Right, and it places the responsibility on the people who are suffering. Oh, you don't think positively enough. It's your fault.
That's right. It can devolve into that. And I think the whole idea of the law of attraction, which started to gain popularity in the positive thinking movement in the late 19th century, was a theological mistake. I won't go into detail now, but it came out of a misreading of some early theological sources that these folks were drawing upon, and it's not necessary to hang on to it. You can talk about and extol the benefits and the possibilities of positive thinking without clinging to this, what I think of as an indefensible idea that our thoughts are the sole determinant of everything that happens to us. That idea will never gain moral traction, and it needs to be reformed.
Well, and in the last chapter of your book, you break down what you see as the different schools of positive thinking.
Yes.
And take away the negative and the positive and point out what seems to work and what seems not to work.
Yes.
Magical thinking or this divine thought school certainly gets the least respect from you.
It's the least practical, it's the least defensible, and yet it's the most popular. You know, this idea that the mind is some sort of a magnetic attracting force. In some people's lives, that is a very, very powerful concept. And there are certain matters of individual faith where no one else can tread but the person, him or herself. But that's the most popular and the least defensible concept. There are other concepts that are more defensible, such as the idea of reconditioning the mind or the idea of undergoing a kind of spiritual awakening or a conversion experience.
Right, which is like
very much
AA.
A metaphysical idea. It's at the heart of AA.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, there are many people who have found a great deal of success with that. And you
yes.
write about how the man who founded AA, Bill, found a great deal of success with that, although the man who gave him the idea did not.
Yes, that's very interesting. You know, Bill Wilson became one of my heroes as I was working on this book. He felt that the solution to addiction was some kind of a spiritual awakening, although it would need to be accompanied by lifelong work. The man who brought him some of the spiritual ideas that Bill used to develop the 12 steps, a man named Ebbie Thatcher, was not able ultimately to quit drinking. And Bill's wife, Lois Wilson, I think made a brilliant observation, which was that Bill wanted to stop drinking with all his guts, with all his heart, with all his soul. Ebbie didn't want it in the same way. And I came to feel that that might be the linchpin to all of these motivational philosophies. Within physical limits, you get what you want, but you absolutely have to hunger after it with all your heart, which is why it's very important for people to be unsparingly clear with themselves about what their aims really are.
Well, and that plays into this column that you wrote that first attracted my attention in Time, and that's one of the things that you want people to do as they make their New Year's resolutions is to be unsparingly honest about personal goals. So the resolutions that we usually make to lose weight, to be more organized, to save money, you don't feel like we're actually getting at the heart of what's really important to us?
That's right. You know, I think too often we repeat comforting inner truths to ourselves, you know, virtues that we say we want to do, that we want to attain. It's not at all clear that we want these things. You know, one of the lessons that I derive from the positive thinking movement is that it's not sufficient to tell ourselves we know what we want. We really need to make a sustained and careful study of it. There are people who say money isn't important to me. They might not mean that at all. Money might be very important to them. There are people who chase after awards and fame and applause. Maybe they really want to be alone. You know, sometimes people who are actually drawn to be introverts act out as extroverts just because they feel that they have to. I'm just saying that people need to keep peeling back the onion on their own desires and get down to the point of what they really want, because it's not enough to repeat to ourselves what we think sounds virtuous or what we think we ought to want.
That's not a New Year's Eve kind of reflection that you're talking about. That sounds like a journey.
It's a journey. It's a journey. And the journey can begun, you know, be commenced any time, really. You know, people have to sit down and start to seriously ask themselves, if I were to make a list of my desires, or if I had to be unsparingly honest with myself about the one thing I most want, you know, write it down and do it every day. Do it every day till you feel like you're being just absolutely unsparingly honest. It's a very simple exercise, but it can uncover surprising things.
Well, and before we get to the other things on the list, let's talk a little bit more about some of the takeaways that you have about what really works about positive thinking. And you kind of break it down into what you call the meaning-based school of positive thinking, which is not really a positive thinking philosophy at all. What is it?
Well, one of the most morally persuasive ideas that came out of the culture of mental therapeutics is that if you can find some kind of meaning in whatever suffering you might be experiencing, that can be enormously fortifying. That can be the beginning of a remarkable personal search. If you feel that you're, rather than being burdened by something, you're in service to something or someone, and you can really explore that idea and take the time to maturely hold it, carry it, sustain it, see if it's morally convincing to you, it can change the tenor of your outlook. It can change the tenor of your existence. Finding meaning in suffering is enormously important. It can be reorienting.
You also write about, of course, we started with mental healing. You write about the placebo effect, which is very real. When people
Yes.
think that they are being cured, often they are.
It's really remarkable. The research into the placebo effect, I think, is going to continue to grow and deepen and expand our questions in the 21st century. I read about a study at Harvard in late 2010 where researchers administered to patients a transparent placebo. In effect, they told people they were receiving a sugar pill. And a substantial fraction of people in this study reported some measure of relief, even when they knew they were being administered an inert substance. And researchers just scratched their heads and said, you know, how can this be? The whole principle of the placebo effect has been based in a kind of deception, which is leading people to believe that they are receiving or that they might be receiving a legitimate medicinal substance. And yet people recorded beneficial effects even when they knew they were getting a sugar pill. It begs so many questions. We're just at the beginning of understanding the placebo effect.
You also write about what we now know, at least a little bit about rewiring our neural pathways through different kinds of thought. And that seems to be a very practical way to apply positive thinking in our daily lives. If we get into the habit of thinking positively, it'll make us feel better.
That's right. Researchers in a field that is now called neuroplasticity have found in brain scans that the biological makeup of our brain and the way our neural circuits actually fire can be altered over time by the changing of our thoughts. And this has been used now for several years as a treatment for people with obsessive compulsive disorder, that if you can direct your thoughts away from whatever ritualistic behavior you're engaging in and do this in a sustained way over time, it's actually been found to alter the brain biology that's associated with OCD. So we're seeing that thoughts, at least in terms of brain biology, do have a detectable physical effect on the brain.
Well, let's get back to the list that you published in mm-hmm. Time. And we already talked about one of the things that made the list, be unsparingly honest about personal goals. The number one thing on the list, though, was try being a little kinder.
Yes.
Why did you put that on your list, and what can it do for me?
You know, a student of the British intellectual Aldous Huxley shared a story with me that Huxley, toward the end of his life, was asked by a journalist of all the various experiments in psychedelics and Eastern religion that Huxley had attempted, what was the one best method he had found for self-development? And Huxley said, just try being a little kinder. And at first I thought he was being glib, or that was just a line to hand to an interviewer. And Huxley's student assured me, no, he was completely serious, that you will experience a greater sense of self-calm if you can just extend yourself a little more to other people. Don't take the opportunity to be harsh with people. Just try to behave a little more decently to other people. And it sounds like such a mundane observation, but it grew out of a lifetime of experimentation on Huxley's part, and he was absolutely serious about it.
And when you learned that, did you change your behavior?
I am trying to every single day. It did make a change in my behavior, but we are like pendulums, and we swing back and forth, and we're also in pieces. You know, the mind says do this, and the emotions say do that.
Right.
The mind says stop smoking, and the body wants to smoke. So these things require a lifetime of effort. They're simple, but they're also very demanding.
Another one on your list, radically forgive even cruel people. That can
Yes.
be one of the hardest things, but what can, in a nutshell, what can forgiveness bring us?
I think it first of all, it brings us the right to ask for and expect forgiveness from other people. And if the individual isn't experiencing that in the present, they're going to experience it. We're all moved around by forces, interior forces that we don't understand. And we hurt other people unintentionally. So first of all, to expect forgiveness, it's absolutely necessary to give it because it will be needed by all of us. And it does bring a greater sense of inner calm and possibility. I think it does help calm some of the thoughts that we're plagued by to forgive other people. It's very difficult because we feel very legitimately sometimes that we have been wronged by other people. But it's the one principle that unites all of the religions of humanity. Forgiveness is absolutely essential.
And we are nearly out of time, but another one, express gratitude daily. Do you have a daily gratitude practice?
I do. I wake up every morning and I try to enumerate things for which to be grateful. We're always surprised. Again, we think we know how to do these things. We think we already do these things. But if you stop and even just take a few moments to enumerate things that you're grateful for when you wake up in the morning, you'll be surprised by where that takes you. There are things that we should be grateful for that we overlook every day.
And finally, you want us to commit to civility.
Yes. That is vitally important, and it's something that we can all do. There is such a coarseness in our communication, not only in terms of what's coming out of television on reality talk shows, political talk shows, or shock jock radio shows, but in emails, in texting, in social network posting. There's a great deal of cynicism, snarkiness. There's a kind of pile-on effect. We can all take a step back and address people in a more courteous and civil way over texts and emails. It's worth taking the time to do that because the alternative is we are coarsening as a culture, and we can open things up for ourselves and for other people if we just show a little courtesy. It doesn't take any great effort to say hi or please or thank you over a text or an email, and it's something we can no longer afford to neglect.
Mitch, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mitch Horowitz is the author of the new book, One Simple Idea, How Positive Thinking Reshaped Modern Life. It comes out tomorrow. And coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with a clinical psychologist who helps people set and achieve their goals. And you can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. So we were just talking about Mitch Horowitz's ideas for New Year's resolutions. Try to be a little kinder, radically forgive even cruel people. And you can find a link to his column about New Year's resolutions on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. But a lot of us have a lot of things that we'd like to change about our lives. Kevin Krumvita is a licensed psychologist at Corridor Christian Counseling Center in North Liberty. He helps people set and achieve their goals, and he is here with me now. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Charity. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And as Kevin and I talk, we also want to hear from you. What are your goals for the new year? Have you had trouble setting goals in the past? Are there questions that you have? Give us a call at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Kevin, when somebody comes to you and they're unhappy with some things about their lives that they want to change, where do you start with trying to help them come up with goals?
Well, my main intervention with people in my therapy office is an approach called acceptance and commitment therapy, which is developed in the School of Contextual Behavioral Science. The main researcher there is Stephen Hayes. And it's a six-point model. And what I work with people, I first of all, increase their awareness about what's going on with them. Okay. I focus a little bit on what their internal experiencing is, like thinking, remembering, what emotions they're experiencing. And then have them practice getting more in touch with that. A lot of what causes suffering is trying to avoid those kinds of things, especially if there's things that are going on there that you don't like. And then I move towards helping people identify what they really value in life, like what is it you want? Okay. And we talk about what you really value, not what your parents valued, not what society values, but what is it that really makes you sing? And it's usually a value is more in a behavioral kind of realm. For instance, let's say the value of health, which is a big one here at this time of year. What do you value about health? What are your intentional values about health? Well, I want to get more sleep, or I want to have a healthier body, or I want to lose weight, those sorts of things. So we take a look at what takes you towards that value and what takes you away from that value. So we do a little exercise that was developed by Kevin Polk back at the Veterans Department in Maine. He's a psychologist, a longtime ACT therapist. By the way, acceptance commitment therapy is called ACT. You go ACT, everybody starts thinking electrodes, you know. But he developed a little matrix where he helps people identify what's a mental experience and what's a five senses experience, and then what's what takes you towards your values and what takes you away from your values in those areas. So let's say I have a mental thought that everything I do, I don't get it right. Okay, so that's a thought, right? And that might take you away from achieving what you really want to achieve. So our minds, which are basically a tool to keep us safe, right, are a tool. You know, our minds are tools. They're not us specifically. So when we're talking about thinking, thinking is a product of the mind. And if you take a look at thoughts as thoughts rather than as truths or beliefs, then you can get some distance from it and not get so caught up in that. So I help people do that. I help them get some distance from their thinking. Then I help them discern, okay, what thoughts take you towards what you want and what thoughts take you away from what you want, okay? What behaviors take you towards what you want? What behaviors take you away from what you want? And then is this thought workable or not? Not if it's a good thought, a bad thought, anything like that, but is it workable? Does it take you towards what you want?
So a lot of us, when we sit down on New Year's Eve or New Year's Day and we write this list of resolutions, we tend to come up with very concrete things like, okay, I want to lose 15 pounds this year. And a lot of the kinds of things that we make resolutions about tend to be symptoms of a problem rather than dealing with the actual problem. So if I wrote down, you know, I want to lose 15 pounds this year, how would you help me find what I really want?
Well, what I do is I'd look at that and say, okay, so you have a goal of losing this weight, right? Okay. But I would focus you back on your intentional value. What do you want to do to promote your health? Okay. So rather than looking at what you don't want, I'd have you start looking at what you do want. Okay. I want to eat more healthily. Okay. So let's talk about that. What would healthy eating mean to you? Okay. So it'd be moving away from foods that promote weight and move towards food that's healthier and does not promote weight so much. You start mapping that out. And maybe having that kind of goal of weight loss in the back, but coming more to what's your experience when you do that? What's your experience when you get more sleep? What's your experience when you do more exercise, you know? And you want to start with something that you can commit to, all right? So there's a couple of types of commitment. One commitment is a decision to lose weight. Okay, that's more of a out of a mind kind of aspect, or what we call reactive mind aspect. You're going to get caught up in that. And then what happens if you get on the scale and lo and behold, you haven't lost any weight. In fact, you gained a pound. Your mind starts ripping on you, right? See, you can't do this. Look at this. And then get discouraged and boom, you're
done.
You're done. But if you're more along the lines of you're doing this in concert with your values, okay, you're committing to take action towards your value of healthier lifestyle, then you can say, oh, okay, my intention, not my need or my goal, but my intention is to move towards my value. One of the things that I want to do moving towards this value, doing things that help me be healthier. Not so much I want to lose weight, but I want to be healthier. So more of a focus on that. And knowing that when we do a commitment like that, a commitment is a process. And you're going to do well some days, and some days you're not going to do so well. But if you stay focused on your value, you can accept that, yeah, I didn't do so well today, but tomorrow's another day, as opposed to getting your mind into it. No, why, wow, right?
Right. My guest is Kevin Krumvita. He is a licensed psychologist and practices at Corridor Christian Counseling Center in North Liberty. And we're talking about goal setting and resolutions. We'd love to hear from you as well. Join the conversation at 866-780-9000. 9100. Do you have a goal that you've maybe renewed every year on New Year's Day that you've had trouble with over the years? Let's talk about that. What are your goals for 2014? 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, you know, we have talked a number of times this hour about the fact that a lot of us do make New Year's resolutions, and this is a time that we think about renewing and we think about changing our lives because of this idea of New Year's resolutions and the fact that it has become something of a tradition for us. Do we set ourselves up for failure by biting off more than we can chew on New Year's Day every year?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, it seems to me, in my opinion, that we set up this societal thing of, okay, got to make resolutions, got to fulfill them. Okay, right away you're setting yourself up for have to, got to, should. Kelly Wilson, one of the developers of acceptance commitment therapy, called words like should, have to, need to, prison words. They just lock you right up and you don't have any wiggle room. The purpose of acceptance and commitment therapy is to give you that psychological wiggle room to make choices. Okay. So you can make a commitment to your values any time, any place, anywhere. You know, it doesn't have to be locked into New Year's or anything like that. It just so happens that society puts a big thing on New Year's resolutions, so we get kind of caught up in that.
And when we make these resolutions, most of us write down more than one or think of more than one when we're setting goals. How do you feel about that, trying to set three or four different goals at the same time, making all these different changes in our lives?
Well, I think what I would counsel is to choose something that you're going to be able to do. You know, just pick one little thing that you're going to commit to. Again, based on your values. Before you even set goals, I would discern your values. What really counts for you, and what are your intentional values around those values? Then start talking about what you want to do in terms of those intentional values. So if you want to increase your exercise, that's an intentional value towards health, right? So what do you want to do with the exercise? Okay. Well, what can I commit to? All right. So. You know, if you go in and I used to lift free weights, don't look like it right now, but, you know, I had a very good free weight teacher. He started me off with nothing, no weight at all, just how I moved my body. He wanted to make sure that I was going to move my body correctly in order not to hurt myself. Then we started just with the bar, no weights on the bar. Well, you know, you're a guy, you got testosterone. Come on, put some weight. No. And you just, but then as you got, so the bar was just like easy, then you put 10 pounds on it. Okay. And then you just keep going. That's kind of, that was successful for me. And I would counsel people to do something that has a very high degree of success and take it easy on yourself.
Yeah. And once you have figured out your core values and figured out what you want to work toward and come up with a goal that really works toward those values and might be achievable, how do you recommend that people track their progress?
Well, your progress will be in the service of your values, okay? Your experience is what I would say look at. How do you feel? You know, how are you what's going on with you? Are you moving towards the life you want? Okay. Not so much getting on the scales every day. Okay. But more along the lines of, okay, what's happening with you? You know, and just paying attention to your experience, being more in the present moment rather than looking at the future. Just constantly being aware of where you're at now, accepting where you're at, where you are now, and committing to the life you want as opposed to the life you don't want. Okay. Or as opposed to what's going on. You're wanting an experience that promotes you as a human being, what the folks in that call a vital life, okay? And as you move forward on these values and your intentional values and what you're behaving, the way you're behaving towards those, then your experience will let you know that things are going right or not.
We were talking earlier about the thoughts that we have that seem to defeat us, and separating this idea of a thought from a truth. And we have an email question asking, how does the personality spectrum of optimist versus pessimist relate to positive thinking? And I'm sure that that's something you encounter with your patients.
Well, optimism and pessimism are categories that we've come up with to define the different styles of thinking, right? Okay. I tend to think of thoughts as a stream, okay? They come, they go. And what I help people do is take a look at the thought stream rather than being caught up in the thought stream. And if you're starting to look at a thought as bad or good, positive or negative, you're caught up in the mind of doing evaluation. You're putting things in categories. Why not just take a look at it as a thought? It's just a thought. Not as it good or bad, but does this thought take you towards what you want or not? In other words, is it workable? Is it work? Does it take you towards your life? Yes, okay. Pay some attention to that. Is it not workable? Is it taking you away from you? Yeah, okay, well, thank your mind for that, and then bring your focus back to what you want.
So can you train yourself to have healthier thoughts that are taking you toward what you want?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
How do you do it?
Okay. Well, one of the things, in acceptance commitment therapy, there's a plethora of exercises that work in the six-part model. Briefly, the model has present moment awareness, acceptance, diffusion, self as context rather than believing you what your thoughts tell you about yourself, commitment to your values and values, identifying your values. So, and those all work in concert. So there's all kinds of exercises that work towards each one of those areas. And I help people, for instance, become more mindful, practice mindfulness on a daily basis, maybe 5 minutes formal, and then more informally. And people seem to catch on to that. You know, they start getting that, and they start noticing a different experience for themselves. And if they're caught up in their minds.
And did you make any New Year's resolutions for yourself this year?
Yes, I'm working on. Every now and again, what crops up for me is incompetency, right? And those thoughts come up. And when they come up, I take a look at them and say, oh, okay, there's this. And I kind of watch them go by. And then I say, does that take me towards being the best therapist I can be? No. Okay. In fact, that's what happened when I got called for the show. You know, I went – at first I thought, nah, I don't know. And then, oh, yes, I can do this, you know. And that's part of my resolution for myself.
So overcoming your natural inclination to say no.
Right.
And what about deciding to come here moves you toward your values?
Well, if I had said, well, I'm not capable enough to do this, I'm buying into my mind telling me, and then that would cascade into, okay, I'm not a very good therapist, and then it just kind of gets snowballs into, oh, well, might as well go out and eat six chocolate bars and crawl into bed, right? You know. So.
Well, I'm glad you made the decision.
Ooh, too much
did.
Personal information.
No. Kevin, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Kevin Krumbita is a licensed psychologist at Corridor Christian Counseling Center in North Liberty. And we've been talking about setting goals and achieving goals and moving toward our values. And again, the conversation we had earlier this hour with Mitch Horowitz about the column he wrote about New Year's resolutions, you can find his column on our Facebook page. We've put up a link in the comments section on our Facebook page. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. And with me in the studio right now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Charity. In the topic of goal setting, we have listeners of our programs. Maybe remember last year we had a native Iowa couple, Grant and Denise Staskel. They sold their house in North Liberty, and they bought a 37-foot sailboat, and they've been living on it most of this last year. They were recently back. I had a conversation with them. So if you don't want to turn green with envy, don't listen to the noon hour, because it's all about a young couple sailing the coast of Southern California.
Living their dreams.
Living their dreams in Baja, California. So it's an amazing conversation about this young couple who took the plunge.
Wow. Well, it'll take us away from this frigid cold today, too. Thanks a lot, Ben. River to River coming up today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.